Please help me welcome Wilmington, Delaware.
Hey everybody, my name's Teddy. I'm an alcoholic. Grateful to be here, grateful to be alive and sober. I don't know how grateful I am that you turned the lights off, but this feels real weird. I feel like I'm being interrogated. Probably interrogate me mentally if you're like me, I don't know. Really, really grateful to be here. I just got back from a retreat this past weekend, and I guess it's like an AA retreat, spiritually, whatever you want to call it. I don't think it matters, but I go once a year for the last 3 years, and I feel like every time I come back, I usually have a commitment lined up at some point, and it's really cool because like I'm just always lit up for Alcoholics Anonymous, but what I experienced this weekend has just recharged me. I saw a kid that walked into this retreat on Thursday, and I don't know, I see the world with my eyes. I'm still judgmental. I don't know if you can relate to that, but my alcoholism shows up at times a lot. Like, I think I know you before I know you. I can judge you based off the sweatshirt you're wearing, what kind of glasses you have on, the color of your hair, you know, the name brand of your clothes. Like, I grew up down the shore, but I also kind of grew up urban. So if like you have a, you know, like a salt life, I'm like, you must be a fisherman slash swimmer. But like, it doesn't, you know, like I just kind of, that's just how I am, you know? And I watched this kid walk in, and he was Hasidic Jewish, and he had like the long curls, and he had the yarmulke on, and he looked very uncomfortable. And I wish I could be in the frame that I was in this weekend often, because I was just in a frame where there was no judgment of that. It was more of like inquisitive. Like, I wanted to know where I come from. How'd you get here? And I know that uncomfortability, because the first year I went, I felt like I didn't belong. And I'm surrounded by a lot of guys who do this deal that sound a little better than me, that appear to maybe doing this deal a little bit better than me. And I don't want to get up there and talk. And the very first year I went, I don't even like to eat before I come to commitments like this. I just feel like I need to be open and not full and tired. And I ate a whole helping of food, and they came up to me and like, hey, you're gonna give the first panel talk on step one. And I was like, oh, I don't wanna be here. And so I knew what he was feeling, you know. And over the course of the weekend, I just watched a little bit, and he shared a little bit about some inventory that had written there. And you could tell it was really hard for him to do that. And then he gets in, it's a bunch of guys. So I'm sorry if this offends anybody, but this is AA. I'm just gonna be honest and open with you. Like, this is a bunch of guys at a retreat, and so there's some things that need to be talked about and that need to be brought to a table in front of a bunch of guys who are doing this deal that normally would maybe not be talked about so much. And we're sitting around at the end of Saturday night, and we're talking about a lot of the things that, and I'll just try to be a little bit graceful with this, but there's some men in the room, so we'll say like that we can watch on our phone for hours at a time. That is probably not good for our relationships or for ourselves. And the conversation was between a couple friends of mine got going, and like, well, what do you watch? Like, what's that look like? And then it just went sick. You know, like it went from like a really healthy conversation to like a just sick kind of laughing at each other kind of conversation. And this kid is sitting next to us, and he like, the look in his eye was like, oh my God, like, and these guys are sober, you know? And I have a desperate fear of what you think of me. So immediately I'm like, oh, this kid's gonna think, Jesus, he'll never talk to me, you know, like, and what's he think, AA? And he politely got up and said, oh, I'm gonna go to bed, guys. And he had an accent, because I think he was foreign. And I was like, oh, this guy's probably gonna never come back to AA again. And so at the end of the retreat yesterday, every year, the very last hour, we just kind of have people come up and say, what are you gonna take back to your community from this retreat? And it usually goes on for about an hour every year. It usually goes on longer. In fact, a lot of us are very long-winded, and we're just passionate, and we get up there, and it's like we're there a lot longer than we should be. And I remember I see this kid come up very slowly, and he sits down, and he says, hi, my name is, you know, and he just started, like, crying. And in the middle of this, he said, I came here this weekend because I didn't know what else to do. I've been sober for 60 days, and I just didn't understand this. And it doesn't really align with some things I believe, but I desperately want to live a better life, and I don't know how to, and this stuff doesn't make sense, but I came here this weekend. And then he made some jokes about some of the sick things that we have been talking about all weekend, because that needs that stuff needs to be brought to the table. You know, I can be 3 and 5 and 7 years sober and think that like the things that I'm doing are not really pertinent to my sobriety. In reality, they are. My life has gotten full because of Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 steps. My life has gotten incredibly just wonderful. Like Bill uses words in this book, like indescribably wonderful and remarkable. And my life has become all of that and then some. And yet I'm willing at times, subconsciously and consciously, to just throw it all away. Because I think that what I'm doing behind closed doors doesn't matter. And yet, I also forget the power of God. And this kid just started weeping and said, because of this weekend, I now know that there is a better way of life that's available to me if I just do what you guys do. And I'm so grateful. And he had to stop talking and he just like wept. I mean, I've never seen a guy in a long time weep like this. And he got up and went into the back room. And you could just hear him bawling. Like tapped into a place that I can be honest with y'all and say I haven't tapped into since I was in detox. Where like it's not like I'm grateful and hopeful. It's like, man, that horror and remorse and like there is no way out of this and there's no way I'm ever going to have a life and how did I end up here again? That's what he was weeping, but on a different level. And the room just got quiet and we looked at each other and there was nothing left to say. It was 11:27. We had another 33 minutes and we decided that that was the moment we should just close this out. Because if anything came this weekend that I just went to, that was it. And that is a synopsis, just a snapshot of what happens in here. And I am so, like, just look at what God has done. It's, at times, like, you know, I was talking to Tom, and we were talking about the amount of people, because my home groups kind of suffer a little bit, and I just, like, I can get, like, I think that you guys are like, oh, we're going to see Teddy C. from Delaware speak to me. And that's not what you're doing, right? You're just coming to hear somebody, whether I was a man or a woman or whatever, talk about what God has done in my life based on some actions that I was convinced enough for a period of time to take that really, I even today, I'm like, I don't know if I'm going to do that, you know? Like, we just spent a whole week, like, what am I not doing right now? You know, I'm not a guy that came in here with, like, 30 amends on my list. I didn't. I don't know about you. I just moved a lot of places trying to escape alcoholism. And everywhere I went, problems piled up on me. They became astonishingly difficult to solve. And people were getting hurt. And I have like at least 150 from the original list, not to mention the whatever I've, you know, added up over the last year or so. And I can make 75 of them and then look around and hear people talking about 15 and be like, I'm doing good, but I'm not. I'm not. There's a lot of work that's left to be done. For me to be free in the way that this book describes. It doesn't matter what anyone else says, that this book describes that I'll be free. And that's just the truth for me right now, and that became apparent this weekend. I have over the last six, I haven't driven in 20 years, legally. I mean, I've driven, I just haven't driven legally in 20 years. You know what's funny is I've been way more messed up behind the wheel, illegally driving, than I ever was when I was legally driving, and it's crazy that nothing came of that, but my parents were born, I mean, I was born in Bermuda, and my parents were in the Navy, and I've had United States citizenship, I mean, I'm a U.S. citizen, my parents were in the military, they're from here, but if you're like me, I don't know, when I'm 29, and I'm in Florida, and I'm doing a bunch of cocaine and I'm drinking a bunch of tequila and I'm living in a motel room and then I gotta leave the next day because I can't afford the motel room. Like the last thing I'm thinking about is my passport. You know what I mean? Well, I don't know, where's my passport before I leave? I just leave. And so I've lost all these important documents along the way. So for the last 3 years, I have been paying down to get my license back, which legally to the state of New Jersey, I can get my license back, but I can't prove I'm a citizen. And that's been going on. And there's been a long road of like, how am I gonna do that? And it's a 9 to 14 month process and it's gonna cost $1,200 for the application fee. But my dad and I have never really had a relationship and he's not easy to get a hold of. And my mom lives in Florida and like, it's been laughable how impossible this has seemed to be. And I just was like, at a point of last year, like, I don't know if I'm ever gonna drive legally. And 2 weeks ago, I finally got a passport in the mail. and I'm set to like just start getting my license back. And while I was sitting at this retreat, it occurred to me that some things happened back in 2012 that I have to make an amends for that aren't even on the list. And I need to do that before I get my license back. And I would hope that, y'all have the same experience I just had this weekend in here, because it's available. Like that level of honesty, like that level of willingness, right? That level of freedom and openness to a new way of life that doesn't just set aside all these things that seem small. That really, like, not to just come in here and want to have a experience so that I can say I did it and sponsor a couple guys and get my family's attention. I mean, I'm talking about like all of it, like really, like for the stars, all of it. Like a new life, a new freedom. Not happiness like I used to know, like a new happiness. And sometimes that exists in a gift that I doesn't appear to be like one I want to open. And man, it's just been a ride. And you know, I don't know what my job is tonight. I can tell you it's supposed to be, you know, what it used to be like, what has happened to me and what it's like now, and hopefully we go there. But I, upon some prayer before I walked in here tonight, it's, you know, like wherever God takes me is what my job is here. So I really don't know what I'm going to say. Hopefully it's him, because if it's not, it's me, you guys are probably in trouble. So with that, loving God separated me from alcohol and all the other forms of it that you can possibly think of or name, except for bath salts. I don't know why I say that. That got brought up at the retreat this weekend, and I was like very curious because I had never done that. I was like, what did that do, right? And they started explaining to me. I was like, you did that. Like real shocked and like judging. Like I was judging from like, you did bath salts. But then I started thinking, I'm like, yeah, I'm sure if there was nothing left, I would have done bath salts too. So, because I've smoked, you know, plaster off the floor, and I'm judging some of you on bath salts. But anyway, loving God separated me from alcohol and other forms of it on May 12th of 2017. And I say that not, you know, if you have a sobriety date, cool. You know, I don't care. This is just my experience. My experience is that for the life of me, over the course of 18 years, I could not, on my own, separate myself from whatever it is that was in front of me that was killing me. I couldn't. I wanted to. You know, I'm a guy that for a really long time had, like, these ritualistic routines of, like, trying to save enough of this and save enough of that so that I could snort a little bit of this and have plenty to drink at the end and maybe take a couple of these and smoke one of these so that I could just pass out and not have to try to lay there for too long thinking about how bad my life was. While making these promises with some really sad music on that, like, this is going to be the last night I do that. And I would repeatedly do that for ever, you know, like every night was the same night. It was just like, I would do tonight's tonight and tonight's tonight and tonight's tonight. And I could not stop doing what I was doing. I couldn't. And I had a sincere desire to not want to do that. I had a sincere desire. How I know alcohol and other forms of it fixed me spiritually is because I'd wake up many mornings with no thought of my son, no thought of my family, no thought of anything. And as soon as I got what I needed, and I'd sit at a bar stool and I'd belly up and I would get just enough to get me to that place where my mind settled down. Bill uses wonderful words, like that mental fog settles down. And I'm able to just like breathe for a second, like, all right, now I can think about how I'm going to do this again tomorrow. And in those moments, I'd be like, God, why can't they just see that I'm a lot better of a dad when I'm like this? Can't they just let me do like a gram of cocaine and just like a case of beer with some tequila every day? Like, isn't that reasonable? Like, don't they see that I'm much more manageable and easier to tolerate when I'm like this? And then I wake up the next morning and that thought's gone until I get it again. And that's what I'm up against when I walk in here, because I can't stop. I just can't. I can't stop. And when you continue to live life how I live, and you get sober, you get separated, or you can stop for a period of time, I am left with the weight of all the damage that I've caused, and I can't bear to face that. And so what's the solution for that? Well, of course I'm going to drink. I can't separate myself from that. And something happened on May 7th of 2017 that I of myself cannot do. I've tried so many times. I do have two home groups because I'm absolutely in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know if you'll be able to get that from this talk tonight, but I love AA. I think I loved AA so much that over the course of the last year, having written some inventory, I have to be careful because really I'm here to worship the power, not to worship AA. And that's the truth. I get fascinated with being up here. I get fascinated with being down there. I get fascinated with listening and putting on workshops and writing inventory and talking about it, sponsorship, and all that stuff is wonderful, and that's what I'm supposed to be doing here. But if there is one who has all power, and that one is God, am I willing to go to any lengths to experience that? And sometimes that means sitting at home with my girlfriend. Sometimes that means putting aside all this stuff so I can go show up for my sister whose fiance is sitting in the detox center right now. Sometimes that means, like, I'm at a retreat and I'm supposed to be present, right? Like, one of the things they say is try not to bring your phone, and if you do, like, just be present here. And I hear that, and I want to be cool, and I want to be liked, and I want them to know that Teddy was the most present person here. And at 7:30 in the morning, my sister's calling me because she knows that there's somebody in her life right now that may be able to help her fiance, and I'm irritated. Because I'm away, like, why couldn't you have called yesterday? But, like, you know, like, I wish I could have called yesterday how many times? But I love AA, you know, I really do. And I have two home groups. The one's Fairfax Speakers Group. We meet on Sunday night. It's a meeting exactly like this, identical. I think the only thing you guys do a little differently is that you read the set-aside prayer. We don't. Everything else is pretty much exactly the same. And I love it because I'm a talker, which you probably have gotten the gist of that. If not, I'm sure you will by the end of this talk. And I don't have to worry about talking. I can just go and sit and listen to a message of recovery. And have someone describe in their own way, in their own language, how they develop their own relationship with God. Like, not get to get wrapped up and trapped by the big book. And when I say that, trust me, like, it's in here, right? What I need is in here. But this is just a finger pointing to the place that we need to get to, which really, as I point outside, I should be pointing in here. It's a design for living that gets me, that points me towards the inside where this power exists that I have never been able to get to. And that's all it is. And what you do with it after, or what I do with it after I've experienced that power is really up to me, and that's what the book tells me anyway. You know, not to get wrapped up in like what he said and she said and he wrote and I quote this, like that's not, I mean, it's cool. It's really helpful when I'm sitting down in front of a new guy, but like, my girlfriend doesn't care if I can quote the big book, right? She wants to know if I'm going to take the trash out without an attitude, you know? Like, that's real. Our first 8 dates, 6 of them were hikes. And when I first asked her on a date over 2 years ago, I said to her, because I'm awkward and full of fear, I knew she liked to hike, and I just, the best I could come up with without God, right? Like this is what I'm talking about. Am I willing to pray in the moments of even something as simple as asking someone out on a date? Do I forget that when I'm cocky, it's worse? Because as I walk down the hallway, like, I'm me. And is that when I get face to face with her, I am the little boy that was always scared of girls. And the best I come up with is, do you hike when it's cold? And she was like, you could just tell, she was like, what? Like, yeah, I like to hike when it's cold. And I was like, cool. And I just walked away, right? Like, that was it. That's all I got. Now I go outside and I'm asking God, like, is this all I have, right? Like, this. And I was like, what do I do? And I walked in and I asked her, like, 20 minutes later, I was like, would you like to go hiking with me? And she was like, yeah, that'd be really great. I don't know why I couldn't have said that the first time, but yeah. And so we went hiking, and we haven't done a lot of that because I'm busy and you guys need me. Marty needs me, you know, like that's, I gotta go speak, right? And like, and 2 months ago, on the day I was supposed to give a talk on steps 10 and 11, I have my routine in the morning, and I love God, and I love what he's done for me, and I try to tap into that every morning. If there's like one thing that I really have not strayed from over the last almost 7 years, has been my morning time meditation and my nighttime meditation. Like, I have to. Like, it's not even, I love to, but I have to, right? Because I've seen some things go south, as I'm about to describe to you. And I pray, I reach out to some family members every morning, I may get my cup of coffee, I go smoke, and then when I come back upstairs, I sit quietly for however long that I can, and I read some things, right? And so I go downstairs to smoke, and she's walking up the steps, because she had to go out in the morning, and I'm already in my head about the talk that I'm supposed to give that night, right? Like, I'm already like, what am I going to say? How cool can I be? You know, like, do I have some knowledge I can drop? So I drop some. And I'm like, this is where I'm going. I don't even see that she's really walking up the steps. And she's got like tears in her eyes. She goes, you know, it's a really lovely morning for a hike, and we haven't done that in a while. And spiritual Teddy is angry, right? Disturbed that she's interfering with my time with God. And she can feel it. I don't even have to say much sometimes. I am a body language, facial expression guy. Like I cannot hide very well what I feel about you or what I'm thinking at most times. Like it's pretty evident. And she could see that I was, and you could tell, like, I don't provide a safe space for her to say stuff. So then she was like, oh, I'm sorry. She said, I know you're, and like, she should never have to feel that way. And so again, like, I don't know, like, I love AA, but like, what am I doing here? And that's the truth. Like staying in touch with that stuff, right? That's what this points me to, is staying in touch and being cognizant and present to every single moment, because that's where God always is. Not like 8 hours away, not in Quakertown, it's 11 a.m., you know, like it's being here. A place that few of us ever really visit. And I don't know, I just think it's important to be also honest with you, so you're not left here with the impression that like I'm like some AA guru. I'm not. I'm just a guy that knows the book really well, right? Doesn't, you know, like I can help guys. I've had experiences upon experiences to show me that God is real and present if I take action, that I can come and articulate hopefully to y'all in a way that makes you want to go do it. But to also to be honest, that there's a lot of work left to do. And I've talked to guys with 35 years who have told me there's a lot of work left to do. So I don't, and it's really cool that I'm interested in that. I hope I remain interested in that. Now, having said all that, I have a sponsor. His name is Brad. Brad hates that I do this, does not care that I do this. His kids never, he just wants to know what's going on. That's all he wants to know, and that's his job. He's not, he doesn't, you know, he's just like, whatever, Teddy. Like, no one cares what you have to say. They just want to hear what God has to say. And I'm like, you know, but they kind of want to hear what I have to say, right? Brad, he's like, no, they don't care. And I'm really grateful because I'm not an easily sponsored guy. I have a lot of opinions and a lot of ideas that have been made apparent to me in inventory. And thank God for that too. Thank God for inventory. You know, if you've written one four-step and you've been sitting here for a little while, our 12-step says at the end we practice these principles in all our affairs. And don't get me wrong, I think love and compassion and tolerance of others is great. But if you're like me, I have the ability through some willpower to live up to that stuff for a little bit. But eventually, like, my ideas start running into me. And I start running into you. And I don't have the ability when you're not doing what I want you to do to practice love and tolerance. I only want to do that when you're doing what I want you to do. Yeah, I'll be loving. But if you're not doing what I want you to do, we got issues. And I got a whole other spiritual toolkit that I can use for those situations. And none of them revolve around love, tolerance, compassion, and understanding, right? It's usually dishonesty and selfishness and abrasiveness and I'm demanding. That stuff didn't necessarily show up in my very first inventory or second. You know, it shows up in like 4 years sober, 5 years. Like, what does my life look like now? Like, what am I doing now? How's my girlfriend? She came in last week to talk to me about her family not listening to her in a conversation. And about, they got into like a really, it was just a tricky topic. Like, and she felt really weird talking about it. And she was trying to tell me how it was annoying that they don't listen to her. And immediately I have ideas about like how the conversation, so I'm like, so what do? I end up doing the same thing her family did. I'm just like head force right in the car. I'm like, yeah, Chloe, you should have said this. And she just sat here like real patiently, like, yeah, you're right. And I was like, oh my God, like, I don't listen to you either, you know, ever. And thank God for the steps, right? The practice, these principles are talking about are steps, in my opinion, 3 through 11. Right? Like, am I still just trying to willpower sobriety? Or am I really, if I have a nightly review that I'm writing and things are showing up after a few days, am I willing to put that stuff down on paper? Am I willing to be entirely honest with some people in my life? Am I willing to continue to revisit the time after time the flaws in my makeup that not only cause my failure, but my relationships failures, my family's failures, my work's failures? Am I seeing that stuff for what it is? Now, am I willing to make some amends with it? Like, am I willing to, or am I just like going to go up to you like I used to for years? Like, I'm really sorry. I had a girl who I work with that I've made amends to 3 times over the last 4 years. And you know what she said the third time, which is about 5 months ago? I said, hey, would you have a moment so we can talk for a few minutes? And she said, are you going to do that thing where you kind of say you're sorry, but you don't really change? And I was like, I was going to until you said that. No, and I did. And it doesn't matter because that's where I get the humility, right? I don't practice. It comes. Like it will be given to me through those kinds of demonstrations. And thank God for having a sponsor. I'm sponsored today. And if I'm not sponsored, like what? I'm not able to see that. I have nowhere to go with that. And I do sponsor other men. And I'm not always out of virtue because my life depends on it. Sponsorship is not service work. It's the work. This is what the whole work guides me to get to that place where I can do that. Service work is the guys who did all the stuff that set up this meeting tonight. GSR, intergroup, all that. That's service. Like sponsorship is the work. It's my immunity to alcohol and other forms of it. And it's not a luxury. It's a necessity. And yes, like it went from being like, I need to do this because my life depends on it, to I wouldn't say completely transcend it like Bill describes, right? Like in the joy and happiness I get out of giving to others, but that's partly of what's happened for me, where it starts to become something that comes from me as opposed to something that I'm just doing as an activity. And I think that's one of the reasons why I can be here. Yeah, I don't know. I don't think my story is that great. It's kind of boring. I'm going to try to tell you all the crazy stuff that I do in sobriety, but I know that's not necessarily all of why I'm here tonight. So I don't know. I know from what I've come to realize is that I've had alcoholism since probably the time I can remember life. You know, that my grandparents raised me. My mom just had issues with a second marriage, and she just could, which wasn't my dad, and she couldn't. It was just constant back and forth, and I was in the kitchen one night upon a conversation where basically what was said is, to my grandparents, you can keep Teddy, but I'm keeping Ryan, which is my brother next to me. And I remember hearing that at 5 years old, thinking, that doesn't sound right, but I'm also not a dumb person, and my life was a lot better materially with my grandparents than it was with my mom, and I kind of knew that at 5. So I wasn't too upset. I was actually really ecstatic, to be honest with you, because they gave me whatever I wanted, whenever I wanted. How I know I have alcoholism, which I would never have been able to tell you then, I just thought this is normally how people acted, is that at 5, 7, 6, 7, 8, whatever, whenever we'd go somewhere and I didn't get a toy that I wanted or something, my normal response was like this, not just anger, like a hatred for them. And these people who I know I love with all my heart, I didn't care where we were, I would just yell at them in stores, in front of family, friends, and just like, I hate you because they said no. When I was 13, I grew up down in Wawa, New Jersey, and there was a boardwalk, if you guys are familiar with, and I'd have friends and I'd go hang out with them, and they were able to talk to girls and I couldn't. And when I just didn't feel like I was getting the attention I wanted, I would like hole up in my room for days on end listening to Sad Boys to Men music and like wondering why I'm having trouble with personal relationships and friendships, because my friends thought that was just weird. And I'd be like, you don't understand. Like you, and it's probably one of the truest things I ever said to anybody, is that you don't understand. Like you don't, they didn't approach life in that way. They didn't have this thing inside of them that I felt, and I didn't know how to put words to that. I didn't know how to tell people I was afraid. The only time I ever knew to tell someone I was afraid is if I, like, I'm not a fighter or wasn't a fighter when I was a kid, and if I was afraid of getting beat up, I could tell somebody that. Aside from that, I never knew how to tell people I was afraid. I never knew how to tell people when I was sad. I would just kind of be a loner. And that all changed when I was 16 and I experienced alcohol for the first time. All these kids that I hung out with all drank. All of them knew I didn't. All of them never cared that I didn't. But I can never feel like I was connected or was able to do the same things that they were able to do with such ease. Like just normal human interaction. And one night, with no intention of drinking, went back to a friend's house. His dad was coming down the next day on the spur of the moment, and they had to get rid of all this booze. And I'll never forget, if you want to know the spiritual relationship I have to alcohol, like I can't remember, I almost forgot today that Chloe told me to put the salmon away because she wasn't going to get there anyway. But yeah, like I remember 26 years ago what I had as my first drink. And it was warm Budweiser and warm Honey Brew. And I'll never forget it. And it was awful, but delicious, if that makes sense, right? It was just warm. I didn't like the taste of beer that much, but I love the way it made me feel. And I would forego the taste for more of whatever that is that just happened to me. And I experienced the allergy from the moment I drank. Like, I didn't know then that I drank more than them. I just knew that I needed more. I didn't pay attention so much to how they were drinking. What I know now is that I drank a majority of that beer. There were 10 guys there, and I drank way more than any of those guys. I was the first person to pass out. I was the first person to black out. I got walked home. Don't really remember much of that. But yet I woke up the next morning sick as a dog and wanted to do it again. And I didn't want to do it again every day. I just knew I wanted to do it again. And for the rest of my high school years, every time I was in an uncomfortable situation, as soon as I drank, everything went away. And I could talk to girls. I'll give you, there was a girl that I went to school with. Her name was Marta. I went to school with her from like fourth grade till I graduated high school. She was like, I mean, if you're a guy in here, I'm sure girls have had, there was always that one guy and that one girl that everybody just likes. Marta was that girl from the time I was a little kid all the way up until, she probably still is now. I'm pretty sure she's married, but. And I sat next to her one day. I went to school drunk the last day of my junior year, and I sat next to her during mass. And I just remember leaning over to her like six times, and I just kept saying, Marta, you're so hot. And I was just so drunk. And I would never, never talk to her that way. I wouldn't even talk to her, let alone talk to her that way. And she was just like laughing. Like, she was like, who is the guy that's, we've known him for years. See, Teddy doesn't do this. And I just, you know, and I just remember the reaction I got from friends was like, that's who I'm supposed to be. And that just continues, man, and it shifts and it changes, and the things I do changes. I go to college, and it's really just marijuana because I was afraid to drink because I knew how I drank in high school, and I knew how much trouble I got in high school, and I knew how much trouble I got my friends in high school with their parents because I'm just the guy that throws up. Everybody just call me Up Chuck Ted, because if you knew I was coming to your party, I was throwing up, right? I was drinking all your booze, and I was throwing up. I tried to throw up on white carpets. I've been left outside. You name it, I've done. I got a friend, I threw up in front of a friend's mom when she got home to bust the party. The first thing she sees is me, and I'm like, hey, Miss Serena, and I threw up, right? And like, that's just the guy I was. So when I got to college, there was a fear of that happening to me, so I didn't drink that much. But I couldn't stop doing what I was doing. I would smoke weed and experience the same consequences in a certain way. I couldn't go to school when I was a smart kid. I wouldn't go to class. Then I end up where I have to go to class for finals, and I didn't go to class. So I didn't know what to do for the finals, and I couldn't stop doing it. And that would go on until I was 21, and I started working at my uncle's bar, and I dropped out of school, and I started experiencing alcohol, and some older men taught me how to drink, and then it became alcohol. And then I started experiencing some other forms of alcohol. And no matter what you interchange, I experienced an effect that I don't forget. I love the effect. I chase the effect. And the thing that never changes is I can't stop. And when I can't stop, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know how long I'm going to drink for. I don't know how long the run's going to last. I don't know what's going to happen when I'm doing it. I don't know who's going to get hurt when I'm doing it. And I definitely have no idea when I'm going to stop doing it. And I didn't know that was happening to me. There's a line in our book, not to bore you with my story, but there's a line in our book that I don't often hear at big meetings I go to. Like, we always talk about the effect produced by alcohol. And that's great because it's obviously explains some things for me. But one of the things I love is in three sentences, they tell me exactly what happened to me. That I formed this habit that I found I could not break. And I found it like 22, 24. And I can remember vivid moments realizing that, man, I am in trouble. I cannot break this habit. I cannot stop drinking. I cannot stop snorting cocaine. I can't, whatever, you name it, I can't stop doing it. And I lose self-confidence. However, I start to become convinced that, like, if I can just get the right girlfriend, if I get the right job, if I'm making enough money, these human things, that my life will change. And while I'm doing that over the course of the next 13 years, my problems start piling up on me, and they become astonishingly difficult to solve. And like I said earlier, the only thing that solves that is a drink. It's a drink. And I just can't stop drinking when I drink. You know, I met my kid's mom when I was 27, and we got typical alcoholism. She was pregnant 6 months later. Then we have a kid, and I remember convinced that Carter was going to be the thing that kept me from drinking. And so I stopped, but I don't stop smoking marijuana. And I remember 6 months in, because that's not what I'm looking for anymore. That's not the effect that is profound with me. And I remember in 6 months, I'm changing this diaper one day, and the thought came to me, it's like, is this all life really is? It's just changing diapers and feeding babies? Like, there's got to be more to this. And I remember as mom got home, I said, can I just go out tonight? I've been good. I've been watching him. I take care of him. She was like, sure. And you know what happens? I don't come home. And for the next 2.5 years, she continues to experience that. And there'll be brief respites and sweet promises, and I'll just drink at home, or I won't drink at all, or I'll go back to doing this, and she doesn't like that, so I go back to drinking, I can't come home. I can't come home. And I went to a treatment center right up the road. This was actually one of the meetings they took me to when I was in Penn Foundation. And I remember walking in this room. I didn't care about recovery. I didn't want to go to an AA meeting. I just really liked a girl, and they said that if we went, I knew she was going to be here because she had left 4 days prior. Just to give you an idea of what happened to me in my first treatment center, like, my kid's mom is bringing my kid to visit me. She's bringing me toiletries. I mean, this is a woman who's like is working now. I'm not working. There's no money coming in the house. She's doing all this, and I'm using phone calls from my counselor to call her so that I can use my actual phone calls to call this girl that I had met while I was in detox, and she was meeting me here. But what I will tell you, I left that meeting is I was like, man, there was like 100, there was like easily 100 people in this room. And I was amazed. I was like, that many people love this thing. I don't remember who the speaker was, don't remember what they said. I don't think I was listening. I don't think I cared. But I remember the one thing I left with, there was a bunch of people in there that were, something was going on in their life. I just didn't think I needed it. And so after 6 months, my kid's mom had experienced enough of untreated sobriety with me and gave me an option. She's like, Teddy, maybe you should just smoke some weed or something because you're miserable. And I was like, thank you. That's all I needed. And I did. And within 2 months, I'm drinking just like I always drink, not coming home like I don't always come home. And she gave me another alternative. You can either be a father or you can go back to treatment and leave. And I was like, I'm not doing either of that. I said, I'll just leave. And so I packed a suitcase, and my autistic kid's crying because he knows dad, and he's on my leg, and I wish I could tell you it was an easy, a hard decision, but it wasn't. It was easy. I don't have a choice. Because my mind says, you'll be a dad. You'll come here. You'll pay child support. You do all these things you have no experience in doing, but you'll do it. And I don't. And that was November 2012. Or 2011, I'm sorry. And for the next 4 years, it's just, you know, I moved to my grandmother's, and I just destroy her life while she's, you know, my grandfather had passed and she's by herself. And then I moved to Florida and I destroyed my aunt's life and I meet this girl and like she realized like it looks like we're on paper, we're the same. Like we drink and do other things the same. Within 3 weeks of living in my little motel room, she's like, man, you're out of control. And I was offended. I was like, what do you mean? We do the same. We're not the same. Yeah. And she like wakes up. I'm shattered that she's like getting in this dude's car. I came to pick her up, you know, and I end up back at my grandmother's. And I remember driving back on this 30-hour bus trip back to Wildwood, New Jersey, Florida. Like, I'm never doing this again. Within 2 hours, my friend's picking me up, and I'm drinking. I don't know how this is happening. I end up dating this girl in New York City who was a lot younger than me, and I'll just be honest. She was 20. I was 33. Her dad came to my job. And I speak a good friend of ours. I love how he says it. I just really love, like, I love the understanding of it. And I'll tell you what that looks like. He always says we speak fluent Vietnamese. Right? Like, I am a victim in every situation. And I used to laugh at that stuff, but the reality is I think it sounds cool, but I don't always understand it. And I'm going to help you understand what that looks like for me. It's like every person in my life who I've met while I'm drinking, I'm telling them the story, and I'm really good at it. And I'm really good at kind of like that I know I'm partly to blame, but I'm pretty sure it's more of everybody else's fault. So I'm not dumb, right? Like, I'm not going to come off it. So I tell them some things. Yeah, I messed up here. But like my kid's mom really did this. And yeah, I messed up here. My grand, and like this girl, I remember this one girl in particular, one of our first dates, we're drinking and I'm telling her this and she's young. And her first reaction is like, man, you should write a book. And I was like, finally somebody gets it. You know, like she gets it. Like, this is, my life has been awful. Maybe I couldn't write a book to save my life. But, you know, she ends up letting me move in with her to New York when her dad literally that day came into my job and said, if you don't stop dating my daughter, I'm going to kill you. It was essentially what he said in a very nice way. And I remember telling him, because I'm kind of drunk still in the morning, I was like, well, you need to tell your daughter that. And I go up there, and within 2 days, they're going to Ireland, and so they're not going to be home for a month, and she lets me move in.
Wow.
And now I'm living in New York City, and I think it's my dream, right? And I make it look good for a while. And while there, she gets pregnant, and she has to have an abortion, because obviously, you know why she has to do that. You know, and I'm a dad, so it hit me in a place in my soul where I started to see a little bit like what I was doing, but I can't stop. Like I can't stop, because now I really got to drink because I know what I'm doing. And so what that looks like is the end of that run. It's this June 8th of 2015, and I'm walking around New York City with a trash bag full of my clothes, and I'm shaking because I haven't drank in about 12 hours. And I got nowhere to go, and I'm hoping my grandmother's going to send me some money. And she sends me some money with the explicit instruction of not coming to see her. Like, don't come to Florida. Whatever you do, here's money, but don't come to Florida. And so I get on the bus, and I go to Florida. And I go to her house, and she gave me an ultimatum as soon as I got to the door. She said, Teddy, you cannot do this here. You got 4 days to figure out what you're going to do. And I did. Thank God she had some medicine in her medicine cabinet that is that at that time was not my thing, but like could help me get through 4 days. And God's miraculous, because in that moment I cannot see what was happening, but my grandmother and I argued all the time. But there was something in that cabinet that for 4 days gave me some relief so that I can get myself into a treatment center in Pennsylvania, and that there was no argument. And in that 4 days, she fed me, which she loved to do. We talked a little bit. She gave me her pep talks. She said some really nice things. She dropped me off at the bus station, and we both cried. And she just said, I really hope you get your life together. And it was the last time I ever saw her alive. And I'm grateful for that, because I don't know what it would have looked like if I didn't have that with her. And so I go to two treatment centers that summer, because I get out of the first one, drink within a week, go back to Penn's Foundation right up the road. Had an experience where a kid approached me at a meeting before that, and his sponsor and him were willing to take me through the steps, and I'm like, that's kind of crazy. I don't want to do that in 6 weeks. I know AA, and AA doesn't do that. That's really weird, and I wouldn't answer their phone calls, but I was getting kicked out of this house because I was drinking, and they found out, so then I called them. Actually, I didn't call the sponsor. I called the sponsee. He was like 10 months sober, and he picked me up in 15 minutes, and he drove me all the way out from Philadelphia to Penn Foundation, and on the way out, he's talking about a four-step, which if you're like me, like I'm sick. Like I need to either get some medicine or you need to shut up. Like I can't. And a four step, like I don't care. You're telling me way too much about yourself right now. And he started talking about this book, and that's even more boring to me. And then all of a sudden he said something which really kind of sparked my attention as much as it could, as sick as I was. And he said, you know, I was getting evicted from my home today. I'm 9 months sober, 10 months sober. And he said, I've made a bunch of amends, so I have a place to go. And he said, my friends are going to let me stay there until I can get off disability in a couple months and get back to work. I didn't even care about that. What I heard was like, this kid's getting evicted from his home that he's living in, and he's helping me. And even in my best moments, I was not willing to help anybody unless there was something in it for me, and there was absolutely nothing in it for this guy. And so when I got to Penn Foundation, he waited 3 hours with me. And when I got to bed, I don't think it was any coincidence that I started to read this book. And I started to really understand what this book was saying in regards to my first step. And like, wow, these guys really have, like, there's, wow, like, I have this thing. The only problem with that is I become really dangerous because I read the book and I knew what the book said, and I got out of there and I got in Pottstown and I'm involved with guys going through the steps, and they're like doing the deal and having experiences, and I'm hanging out with them. So I believe I'm kind of going to get the experience by hanging out with them. And if you would have heard me in meetings back then, you would have thought that like, I had somebody come up to me, I was talking about To the Wives, I shared from the floor, and they were like, hey, can you do this big book for us next week? And I was like, sure. I had just finished writing Inventory, but like it was very clear with my sponsor after we did a fifth step, I was not making amends. Like, I'm not doing that right now. And he's like, well, maybe you should help some people, and that'll light a fire under you to make some amends. I was like, I'm not doing that either. Like, I got money in my, you know, saved for the first time. I got a job. Like, I'm playing golf. Like, I'm busy, dude. Like, I'll do that shit later. You know, and I'm in meetings talking about paying child support for the first time, and two things are happening. At once I'm having these old guys come up to me and tell me real men pay child support, which really annoyed me, and I didn't want to talk to them anymore. And the other side, I have guys coming up to me, and because I'm talking about a new life that's kind of happening, but not really happening in the way it should, and they're asking me for help, and I don't want to help them, so I will buy them a big book to absolve myself of some guilt, and I'd point them in the direction of someone in here that could help them. And I wonder why at 10 months over, I'm feeling miserable. And I can't put words to it. And I can't tell you I'm afraid. And I can't tell you I'm irritable, although my face says it and my actions say it. And I don't want to go to AA meetings anymore. I kind of like my home group where they don't talk about the steps, they just talk about their problems. And the day of the year, I drank, dude. I literally woke up the day of the year, got my coin a day later, fought the idea for a week. Our book says at certain times we have no mental defense, and that's true. At certain times I do have a mental defense, and I thought about the consequences, and I thought about being homeless. I even went to a meeting very much like this down in Amboy, Pennsylvania, spoke for an hour. At the end of that meeting, a guy came up to me and said, you just described the insanity of alcoholism for 55 minutes, and I was like, that's right, because my story is awesome, you know? And what I didn't understand is that he was actually telling me, you didn't talk about anything. And the reason I was so there is because I was going right back to it in 4 days and didn't even know it. And 4 days later, a week after having the year, I drank. And I didn't get kicked out of the sober house. I spent all my money. I went out, which I thought was really going to last me a week. And when you drink like I drink and you do other things like I do other things, it lasted me 24. I swear to God, 24 hours. And I'm sitting there. Now I have no place to go. I don't think I can go back there. And I'm broke. And I'm like, what did I do? You know? And they didn't kick me out. They said, you know what to do. And the sad part is I didn't know what to do. And I laid in that bed for 2 days and I couldn't get the thought off. And I was like, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? And then finally the thought clicked. I was like, maybe if I just go to the hospital and tell them I'm in pain because I've had medical history before, they'll give me something. I can sleep tonight and I'll go back to an AA meeting. And I went to the hospital. They did give me something. I did not go back to an AA meeting. They told me, if you don't feel better, come back tomorrow. I'm not in pain, by the way. Not in pain at all. Telling them I'm an 8 or a 7, like 7, 8. You can't tell them 10 because then there's something really wrong. You'd be unconscious if your pain level's a 10. I was smart enough to know that. So I was like 70, but then they give me the meds, and you can't say it goes down to a 4 because then they're going to say, oh, you're okay. I was like, it's still a 6, you know, and I just knew this from having prior history. Not in pain at all. And I went back on Friday. They kept me for 8 days, released me. I came back 3 days later, told them I'm still in pain, and the long story short is I ended up having a surgery I didn't need. Yeah, they cut me from here to here to remove some scar tissue that I did have. It was funny, the guy told me, you ever try to sponsor somebody and scare alcoholism out of somebody, right? I've heard people say you could die from this, and it doesn't, like, I don't, that doesn't, sometimes I will, sober or not sober, I'm welcoming that idea. Like, I want it to be over. I tried being sober, I am sober, nothing's getting better. So what's the point? And then drinking, I can't stop drinking. I can't stop living this life. Everything is horrible. What's the point? I've been Narcan once, and I woke up and I was like infuriated because I didn't even know I was, I thought I was sleeping. I didn't even know. There was no pain. I mean, that's like, I don't even know, man. And the guy came in to me and said, you know, we're not finding anything off these hundreds of tests we've done over here the last 2 weeks. CAT scans, x-rays, barium x-rays, you mean like endoscopies, colonoscopies, which like no 35-year-old guy should have, right? Like, you know, you're not ready for that. Like, I had all the, and they're like finding nothing. And he said, scar tissue can cause the kind of pain you're describing, like 1% of people. You could possibly be the 1%. He's like, so the only thing we can do is we can cut you. And if you guys are like me, it was like, well, I know that that means I'm getting loaded for free for at least the next month. And the funny thing is that's not, opiates aren't even my thing. I'm an alcoholic and a cocaine addict, dude. And I used to judge people in AA for that stuff. Here I am, now I'm hooked. And you know how that story goes, and on May 7th, 2017, I'm coming home from my job on my birthday, and no one's wishing me happy birthday. No one in my job talks to me anymore because of what I've been doing to relationships by doing what I'm doing when I go there. And a moment of when I tell you, right, like my, like I don't surrender to this. I was just surrendering. Like I just like, I wish I could, I wish my body language could be on a poster for, because it was, it didn't look like, yeah, I'm ready. It just looked like, I don't know. Whatever, dude, I'm tired. Like, I can't, and I say, God, if this is real, please help me. And the first thought was like, you're gonna die doing this. And the second thought that came, which is really the sound reasoning that our book talks about, which doesn't look like sound reasoning when this thought's happening, is that, Teddy, you don't die fast enough. And the reason I know that, when people tell me I'm gonna die, it's like, well, I'm still here. When I hear guys in meetings sharing the next one, I know I would die at the next time I'm going out. It's like, you're saying that after a relapse, and you're here. The bitter end is like the guy on the street who's homeless, who can't get back here, and yet is living a miserable, robotic existence of getting up and trying to figure out how he's going to get high enough and drunk enough to be homeless, and just keeps going and going. And like, that's the bitter end. That's the thing I'm like, that's the thing that can happen to me, and has happened to me. Like, knowing those doors are there and can't get back. And this guy had been reaching out to try to get me out to a treatment center in California, and I was pretty sure it was an insurance scam, and it was. And I don't really care about it anymore because I got help. And they put me in a place where I was exposed to the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous in a big room. No one that worked there talked to me about anything else but that. First treatment center I've ever been in that ever did that. And my counselor was a guy who had an experience with the 12 steps, and I'm half black and half white, and he's a white guy that was in the California prison system and had experienced some things in there, which all I'm gonna say is when he took his shirt off the first day of med, he had some tattoos that made me think that he would not like me and who I was. And after 3 days, I realized that because of the direct result of this stuff, that was not the same guy I was sitting in front of me. And then just like myself, he had some things by fear, and because of this stuff, he had to change. And he gave me one suggestion. He said, there's an old guy that'll come around here at the house that you're staying at that was willing to take you through the 12 steps. He's like, Teddy, you know a lot about this book, but you've never done it. And he's like, I would strongly suggest doing it while you're here. And this guy, Fred, approached me literally later that day over a game of pool, and this is how quick my nine snaps shut. I was willing in that moment, but like 5 hours later, I'm kind of like, I don't know about Fred, you know? And he approached me. He's 80 years old, 40 years sober, living on this mountain in California with no family. And he was just doing exactly what this big book told him to do. Like, just go help me. And he started talking. I said, Fred, I know how AA works, man. We don't go through the steps in treatment. So I'll get a sponsor when I get out of here. Thanks. And he just looked at me with no judgment. He said, kid, I hope you don't forget why you're here. And if you ever want to talk, I'll be in that room every day. And just walked away from me, doing exactly what the big book says. Not trying to convince me of alcoholism that I might not be sure I have yet, not trying to chase me, not wasting time, because there's 30 other guys here that may want to do this and I'm not wasting time with you. And that interested me. And so I went to work with him and I argued with him. And then next thing you know, Fred brought in the 12 and 12 the first day we met. And I don't know if you can tell, but one of my defects is arrogance. And still to this day. And I walked through my big book and I was like, oh no, Fred, we don't do the steps out of 12 and 12. He's like, have you ever done the steps before? I was like, yeah, kind of. He's like, well, what does that mean? He's like, you didn't make amends, right? I said, no. He's like, you ever help people? No. And he's like, so then 10 and 11 really aren't happening for you. He's like, so you haven't been through the steps before? I was like, okay, Fred, if you want to look at it that way, you know, like, I mean, sure, technicalities. And I was like, well, this isn't going to work. And then all of a sudden, the day we're supposed to write inventory, he walks in with an outline of a four-step like our big book describes. And he didn't want much. He just wanted me to get down the causes and conditions very quickly, and he left me for 2 hours. I wrote, he came back, we shared, had a big turnaround, and I started to see some things for the first time in my life from an entirely different angle. I started to see that my mom didn't hate me, she loved me. She loved me so much she wouldn't let me be raised in a house with a drug addict and abusive person, that she'd rather me live with my grandparents. And for the first time, it was made clear that maybe she loves you more than your siblings. And without this, I can't see that. And I left there, and I knew I needed more. And Fred said, you know, I said, Fred, should I make some amends when I leave here? Because I'm not from California. I didn't have any amends there. I didn't think there was any way I could do that. And I was being sarcastic, because that's another one of my defects. And Fred said, I would strongly suggest you figure out a way. God will show you how. And I get out of that treatment center. And within a month, I got a job. And I got called in the office, and they were like, hey, you've got 8 serious charges that came back on your second background check. From 2012 in Pennsylvania. We don't want to fire you. We really like you, Teddy. They're like, we're going to give you a week to figure out what you're going to do. And so I go there. I got a sponsor, and we started going through the steps a little bit more thoroughly this time when I got out. And I called him, and he said, what happened last time you came to AA and didn't want to make any amends? I said, well, I drank. And he said, didn't you almost die too? And I said, sure, I did. And he said, well, what do you think you should do? And I was like, yeah, but like, I'm a worshiper of my mind. Like, logic and reason makes sense to me. So I was like, well, I got a job. I should save up money. And then go back in like 6 months with bail money. And he said, have you ever been able to do that in your entire life? And I said, no, but I'm sober now, you know, and I'm doing this deal. And he's like, yeah, I don't know. And I said, it doesn't make sense, man. What about my family? I was like, doesn't the book, so I'm dangerous, right? I said, doesn't the book say I'm not supposed to do this if it places my family at risk, and me being in jail puts my family at risk? And he said, when was the last time you saw your son? And I said, 6 years ago. And he's like, does your kid's mom answer phone calls? I was like, no. And he's like, what about the rest of your family? I was like, they haven't talked to me in forever. He's like, and your grandmom's dead. And I said, yeah. He's like, so you have my family. He's like, maybe you're doing them a favor by being a Joe. I was like, well, that's a little bit obnoxious, but all right. And then 4 days later, I was on a plane flying home to Pennsylvania, Montgomery County Courthouse in Norristown. And my kid's mom said she would come and help as long as I provided a picture that was outside the courthouse, because I don't show up for anything. And I did, and she was there within 45 minutes. Now, when I walked in there, I also had $20,000 of years of child support. I'm not a good father when I'm not doing this. I'm just not. And that's the truth. And they arrested me on the spot, and they put me in a holding cell. And I was told that even if the judge was lenient, you got these arrears, you're going to jail today at some point. And the moral of the story is I walked out of that courthouse a free man that day. The judge gave me a treatment as time served, provided I go back and complete the rest of the treatment and IOP that I had. He gave me 6 months probation I could do online and from California as long as I let them know if I moved anywhere, and a huge fine. And they let me go. And I was amazed, but I knew I shouldn't be being let go. And they were giving my shoelaces back. Now, I just had a spiritual experience, but I'm not that spiritual yet. I was not going to remind anybody that he forgot about the child support. So I hightailed. Like, I just like ran out of that courthouse, and I'm chasing my kid's mom down because she's got my stuff in her car. When I get to the car, she's crying. She goes, you have no idea what I did for you today. And I said, B, I do. I really appreciate that you did this today and you were here all day, blah, blah, blah. And she was like, no, you have no idea. She's like, while you were in there, I went across the street to family relations and I absolved you of all your arrears and of having to pay child support for a little bit. because the guy sitting in front of me right now, I have no idea who that is. But whatever it is that you're doing out there, please go back and continue to do it, because this is the guy that I need to be a father to my son. And for the first time in my life, I had experienced what you guys have been promising me that I would experience in here. And it wasn't freedom from debt. It was a new way of, like, it wasn't the what she did, it was that she didn't recognize me. And I didn't even know what was happening. And so when I left there, I went back to California. I saved money for 6 weeks, first time I've ever really done anything like that. Got a bus ride home to Wilmington. At 5 months over, taking a Greyhound bus across the country. And I don't know if you guys have any experience with that, but they're not the best stops. I have been approached, I could drink if I wanted to get hot, whatever. I think somebody asked me to sell myself for some drugs, like at one point. And I was free. I was experiencing everything on page 85. Like freedom. I've been removed based off some actions that I was told to take that I did. The miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous happens when one alcoholic convinces another alcoholic to take some actions that we would never dream of taking. And that happened. And I don't know how it happened, but it happened. And since then, I've God has shown me how to create a fellowship I crave in Delaware. Like, I'm deeply involved and embedded in AA in Delaware. And I don't say that like out of ego. I say that because, like, I didn't think I'd ever want something like that. When we put on a cool workshop in March, if anybody wants information on, we can get with each other after the meeting. I mean, it's just, I've seen lives change. I've had a guy take his mom to Florida for his 2-year anniversary and didn't even ask me about that. And I thought, I mean, these are the things I've gotten to experience that I never thought I'd care to experience. I lost my father last year. There's so much I can tell you. Like, I'm a father today. And I'm a financial father too. Like, I take part financially in his life. And me and my girlfriend took him to Paw Patrol Live this year, and he loves Chloe. And the more if you have any kind of family dynamic like this, just to paint a picture for you, the last two Christmases, we go to my uncle's house on Christmas Eve every year. And my girlfriend, my son's mother are with my family on Christmas Eve together. And as scary as it sounds that my kid's mom and my girlfriend talk, it's frightening. You know, like, I always got to check in to make sure that they're not exchanging stories. But God brings these families together. People that you never thought would ever coexist are together. And, like, I don't do that. Like, that's not me. It's just from taking some actions, allowing God to do the work. My dad passed away last year. He had siblings I didn't meet until 4 years ago. And we've been friends on Facebook, but I didn't meet them 4 years ago. And over the course of the last 4 years, we've all kind of grown together. And when he passed away last year, I got to show up. And the youngest one is from another marriage. My dad's an alcoholic, and he likes women. He was married like 5 times. And the third marriage, he had this girl. And she doesn't have any, like, she has 2 siblings that she doesn't talk to. And she somehow became very comfortable with me. And so when we went to his funeral, we got an Airbnb, and we brought her with us, and we took her back to Rhode Island. And long story short, she has nowhere to go. Her mom died of alcoholism. My dad died of alcoholism. And she's by herself in the world. And she's 26, and she's got mental health issues. And we got to provide a place for her to be safe for Christmas this year. She got to come down on the train from Rhode Island and spend time with us in Delaware for 11 days. And we got to provide her presents for Christmas. And we got to take her to my family's house. She got to experience family for Christmas for the first time in like 9-10 years. And really probably for the first time ever. And while we were there, I had a commitment her last night here, and she really wanted to go. And I was like, "You really don't want to go hear me speak, sis." And she was like, "I really want to go." And I was like, "All right, whatever." And she came. And at the end of the commitment, we got in the car, and she said, "That was one of the coolest experiences I've ever had." And I said, "Well, what did you get from it?" She's like, "Well, I know I'm really screwed up at 26, and you're obviously really screwed up." And she's like, "And I got some hope tonight that it doesn't matter how screwed up my life is and how mentally ill I can be sometimes, that there's hope for me somewhere." And that's what you guys have allowed to have provided for people like my sister. And I'm forever indebted to that. And that doesn't happen because of me. It happens because this book, with some simple instruction, points to a place deep inside of me that allows me to experience the power that allows me to be transformed in the world and to help others. And that's a gift, man. And if you're in here and you're new and you're struggling with the idea of power, I don't know about you guys, but when I'm in treatment, I'm very rarely ever thinking about you. You know, like, It's usually like cereal, that generic stuff, good stuff, right? Peanut butter and jellies. How many cigarette breaks do I get? Do they provide cigarettes because they usually don't have them? Do the girls cute? You know, like things like that, right? I'm a guy who's called my kid's mom two separate times on two separate Mother's Days from two separate facilities asking for cigarette money without saying Happy Mother's Day because I was almost unaware that it was Happy Mother's Day. It was Mother's Day. And 87 years ago, our co-founder was in a very similar situation in a hospital bed in a detox, having had just an incredibly profound spiritual experience, and had to ask a doctor if it was real. They weren't even sure. And the first thought that came to him is, I would love to, if 1,000 alcoholics love to have what was so freely given to me. And because of that thought, we're all here together on a Monday night, 87 years later in Quakertown. And if you asked me 6.5 years ago if I would have thought that that was cool, no way, you know. But the central fact of my life is there is absolutely nothing more powerful and cooler than that. And that's all I need to know about the power that exists here. So with that, thank you for having me. God bless you, God bless your families, and God bless AA.
The group would like to thank Teddy again for sharing his experience with us tonight. The group would also like to remind anyone in need of a sponsor to please see someone after the meeting. Would anyone who has working knowledge of the 12 steps please raise your hand? Please help us close the meeting with the Lord's Prayer. Teddy, you want to take a slide?
Sure.
Lord's Prayer.
Lord's Prayer.
You got some hands. Let's have a moment of silence for the slow, sick, and suffering that are inside and outside of these rooms.